From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In the 1960s, Ken Kesey was one of the most popular novelists and most celebrated hippies. On this edition of Fresh Air, the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest tells us about his latest project. Also, Lester Brown of the World Watch Institute gives us his group's annual assessment of our planet's health. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from singer-songwriter Dave Frischberg. And TV critic David Bianculli checks out the new telemovie about writer Ian Fleming, the man who created James Bond. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli cabinet ministers from Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir's hard-lined Likud bloc have conditionally approved U.S. proposals for Middle East peace talks. The unanimous decision follows a five-hour meeting in Shamir's office. The White House today played down rumors that one or more of the Western hostages held in Lebanon might be released soon. Rumors of an imminent hostage release circulated through the weekend after a London newspaper said delegations of Iranian officials were visiting Syria and Lebanon for talks on the matter. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said today that the Bush administration had no indication that a hostage release might come soon. He said the U.S. is ready and eager to talk with Iran about the issue, but insisted that there are no talks underway and that there will be no deals. Jury selection began today in the Iran-Contra trial of former National Security Advisor John Poindexter. Poindexter is charged with five felonies, including lying to and obstructing Congress. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
By day's end, the judge in charge of the case had qualified some 21 jurors to serve and excused six. At least 40 must be qualified before the process of each side striking limited numbers of jurors at will can begin. But it was clear today that John Poindexter is not the emotional lightning rod that Oliver North was, and more time has elapsed since his congressional testimony as well. Many well-educated jurors were ruled qualified today to sit on the Poindexter case. It looks like picking a jury will be relatively easy. A panel of 12 plus six alternates should be sworn by week's end. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
In the rough-and-tumble Texas governor's race, candidate Ann Richards came out fighting in Austin today to confront persistent questions about illegal drug use. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Ann Richards, who was until recently the Democratic frontrunner for governor, says she's tired of being pestered and she's decided to fight back. For the last few weeks, the 56-year-old state treasurer and recovered alcoholic has been dogged by the question, has she ever used illegal drugs? This afternoon at her campaign headquarters, a steely-faced Richards fired back at her two aggressive Democratic opponents.
I've been sober for 10 years. Have Jim Maddox and Mark White been honest for 10 years?
Both have been using to their political advantage her refusal to answer clearly yes or no whether she has used illegal drugs. Richards maintains that continually raising the drug issue only discourages other past victims of any type of addiction from going public. But political observers say the question is bound to resurface if she makes it through next week's primary into the runoff. In Austin, this is John Burnett reporting.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today in light trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 11 points to close at 2,649.55. This is National Public Radio News. A ruling today by the Supreme Court could invalidate the sentences of most of the 85 death row inmates in North Carolina. By a 6-3 vote, the court overturned a key provision of North Carolina's death penalty law. The provision forbids jurors from considering any factor suggesting a lesser sentence unless all 12 jury members could agree on it. The decision's not expected to affect any death row prisoners outside North Carolina, but it could force new sentencing trials for as many as 70 inmates in the state. The suspension of an FBI agent in Miami has become the source of a major controversy. As Jeff White reports, there are conflicting stories as to why the officer was placed on leave and lost his security clearance.
Fernando Mata is a counterintelligence specialist with the FBI in Miami. His lawyer, Hugo Rodriguez, claims the Bureau has been investigating Mata in regard to possible contacts he had with Cuban intelligence agents in years past. But Rodriguez told the New York Times his client never did anything wrong, and that Mata's suspension and loss of his security clearance are acts of retaliation for Mata's criticism of FBI discrimination against Hispanic employees. Mata testified about the FBI's discrimination tactics in a highly publicized trial in 1988, which resulted in a federal judge ordering the Bureau to make major changes in its internal promotion policies. So far, official FBI sources have refused to confirm that Mata is being investigated for Cuban spy links. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
Three police officers were wounded today, one of them critically, when an undercover drug buy in New York apparently went sour. Police said the three were members of a federal drug enforcement task force trying to buy narcotics in a high-rise housing project on Manhattan's Lower East Side. They were wounded in an exchange of gunfire with five suspects. One of the suspects was also wounded. He was arrested with two others. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ken Kesey wrote two of the more popular novels of the 1960s. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is set in a mental institution where the patients rebel against the sterile, repressive hospital regimen. Sometimes a Great Notion is set in Oregon logging country. But in some circles, Kesey became even better known as being one of the first people to bring the experimental hallucinogen LSD out of the research laboratory and into the culture. Kesey and his friends, known as the Merry Pranksters, were among the first and most celebrated of the West Coast hippies. In the book The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, Tom Wolfe described their escapades driving around the country in their Dayglow school bus. The driver was usually Neil Cassady, who was immortalized as the character Dean Moriarty in Jack Kerouac's novel On the Road. Ken Kesey hasn't published much since then and has remained pretty much out of the public eye. He lives on a farm in Oregon. His short pieces from the past two decades were collected in the 1986 book Demon Box. His latest project is the book Caverns. It's a collaborative novel written by the students in his writing class at the University of Oregon. The authorship is credited to O.U. Levin, which is an anagram for University of Oregon Novel. The book includes an introduction by Kesey. I asked him why he had his class write a collective novel.
It's an idea I've had for a long time, for a number of reasons. I feel that a lot of writing classes end up being in competition with each other, and that's the best they get out of it. It's kind of intellectual, literary infighting. And we came out of a very exceptional class in the 60s that all of us who were part of the class are kind of in awe of now that it's passed. And I wanted to create this same sense of all of us being part of a team working for the same goal at the end of the project, and so that we weren't in competition with each other in any form.
Did you do writing yourself?
We all did, yeah. When we first met, I told them there's only two rules that I have for this class. One is that we can't tell anybody the plot of the novel until it's done. Your wife, reporters, nobody, no English professors. And the other one was that I make up half the class, so that if it came down to a real argument about where the novel was going, that all they could do was tie me up. They couldn't, all I had to do is browbeat one of them, it would go my direction. I told them, this is not democracy, this is art, and we've got to keep going forward with it, because otherwise we'll get in there, we'll be talking about the difference between Henry James and Hemingway.
How much writing have you been doing over the past few years?
Oh, quite a lot. I write all the time. Mm-hmm. I just don't publish that much. For one thing, I've got a lot of other stuff that I'm doing. I've got a large farm. I was going pretty good on a book in 1984 and had a kid die, and it really took the wind out of my sails, and I've felt like this working this with this class at the University of Oregon got me moving again. I'm turning out quite a bit of manuscript now that I haven't for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You know, you say something in the introduction to Caverns that I wanted to ask you about. You write that you'd studied with Wallace Degner at Stanford. And you write that in your university days, he mistook you for an anti-intellectual, But what you really were was a near illiterate. Elaborate on that.
Well, as I told you, I majored in radio and television. I knew Fibber McGee and Molly and Jack Benny, but I wasn't too well versed in Faulkner and William Blake. Those were new things to me. When I got down to Stanford, I realized that I was not nearly as well read as most of the other people in the class.
Were you uncomfortable about that? Did you feel like you had all this catching up to do?
I felt like a country fool walked in with stuff between my toes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're living on your farm now.
Same old farm, yeah.
You know, it's funny, in your prankster days, you were seen as being part of a group that had made such a break with the past. And yet here you are living on a family farm. It had been owned by someone else in your family before you. You're, I believe, still married to the woman who you've been married to since, what is it, 1956?
Long time, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's been this incredible continuity in your life between past and present in a lot of ways.
Well, old Tommy Wolfe has a lot to do with that misconception. When New York wants to view somebody's personality, they want it in terms of a sound bite. They don't want to have it get too complex. It's like coming over here tonight. We got out there in the traffic, and we come in here late, and I just hate to come into a place late because I know that's what they expect of me, you know, because of my prankster upbringing. I know that, yeah, here he is, he's late, just he's probably messed up, but I'm not. I've always been a fairly reliable, straight-up, the-middle-of-the-road citizen that just happens to be an acid head.
You say that you blame Tommy Wolfe for these misconceptions about you're referring to Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Did you like the book?
Oh, yeah, it's a good book. Yeah.
And do you feel... Yeah, go ahead.
Wolf's a genius. He did a lot of that stuff. He's only around 3 weeks. He picked up that amount of dialogue and verisimilitude without tape recorder, without taking notes to any extent. He just watches very carefully and remembers. But, you know, he's got his own editorial filter there, and so what he's coming up with is part of me, but it's not all of me, you know, any more than Hunter S. Thompson is loaded all the time and shooting machine guns at John Denver. That's the sort of thing interesting in the media, but he's got a lot more life to him than that.
Ken Kesey is my guest, and he has a new book that's actually a collaborative book that was written by his students. And the book is called Caverns. What effect did the electric Kool-Aid acid test have on you? For instance, did it make the police feel more determined to try to bust you again?
Yeah, but I haven't been worried about the cops that much. The effect Kool-Aid acid test has is it's as though, say, that you're Richard Gere, and you got a great big wart on the side of your nose, and they begin to play it up in the cameras, and then pretty soon it becomes a thing that a lot of teenage girls are in love with, and pretty soon you're looking at it, too, until you're cross-eyed looking at your own wart.
Why do you use the wart as an analogy?
Well, because I was a lot more than the Tom Wolfe depiction, and I think this is a problem for a lot of American writers and has been for a long time. You know, Hemingway, he doesn't really get into trouble until he becomes dazzled by his own image. He sees the rest of the United States looking at him, and he moves over and sits there, and he looks at himself, too. And then when he tries to go back and get inside of his own skin, he can't quite fit into it as well as he used to. He's gained weight. He can't put his own skin back on. And when you're writing, it's not a good idea to be observed too much, unless you want to live in New York and wear white clothes. If you really are interested in being a real straight, old-fashioned writer, it's better to live down in Mississippi like Faulkner and work out in the woodshed and not be seen but once every 10 years. I think that being the observed always turns your eye back on yourself, and you become kind of blinded by your own radiance.
You started doing LSD through a government experiment, an experimental program, and I think it was 1959. And you were one of the volunteers who you know, volunteered to take this experimental drug and have it tested on yourself. How did you become a volunteer for these experiments?
One of the guys that was our neighbors was he was a psychologist, and he was supposed to show up one day and just really didn't have the common hair to do it, and says, "Would anybody else like to take my place?" And I, at the time, was training for the Olympics. I made it to be an alternate in the 1960 Olympics team and was in
good
shape.
As a wrestler?
Yeah, as a wrestler. I'd never been drunk on beer, you know, let alone done any drugs, but this is the American government. They said, "Come in here. We've just discovered this new spot of space, and we want somebody to go up there and look it over, and we don't want to do it. We want to hire you students." And I was one of 140 or so that it eventually turned out it was CIA-sponsored. I didn't believe it for a long time. Well, Allen Ginsberg says, "You know who was paying for that? It was the CIA." I said, "Oh, no, Allen, you're just paranoid." But he finally got all the darn records, and it did turn out the CIA was doing this, and it wasn't being done to try to cure insane people, which is what we thought. It was being done to try to make people insane, to weaken people and to be able to put them under the control of interrogators. This didn't, we didn't find this out for 20 years. And by that time, the government had said, "Okay, stop that experiment. All these guinea pigs that we've sent up there into outer space, bring them back down, and don't ever let them go back up there again, because we don't like the look in their eyes."
Do you remember what your very first trip was like when you were a volunteer in this government program? And what kind of preparation were you given for it? Were you given any?
None at all. Except I'd read a little piece in Life magazine about how they'd given it to cats, and cats were afraid of mice once they'd had LSD. But I think that we'd been preparing for a long time. You know, I knew the Bible. I knew the Bhagavad Gita. I knew the Tao Te Ching. I had read Hermann Hesse's Journey to the East, which gave us an underpinning spiritually so that these phenomena that were happening to us had something that we could relate to. I think a lot of people who are just jumping into drugs now, they don't have anything to relate it to, and I think people have been, for one thing, people have been doing psychedelics for thousands and thousands of years, trying to find out what's on the real books, and we just happened to come at a time when it was not only a lot of stuff happening chemically, there was a lot of new changes in music and in film. Burroughs was just beginning to do his work in literature. There was a movement afoot that this was just a part of, and mm-hmm. It was exciting. It was wonderful.
What was that very first trip like, though, under the experimental conditions?
Groovy, man. It was groovy. We suddenly realized that there's a lot more to this world than we previously thought. I think, because I'm asked this question a lot, it's been 20 years or so, and people are always coming back saying, "Well, what do you think?" And one of the things that I think came out of it is this, is that there's room. We don't all have to be the same. We don't have to have Baptists coast to coast. We can throw in some Buddhists and some Christians and people who are just thinking totally strange thoughts about the Irish leprechauns, that there is room spiritually for everybody in this universe.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Ken Kesey. His novels One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Sometimes a Great Notion were among the most popular novels of the 1960s. Kesey's exploits with the group known as the Merry Pranksters were chronicled in Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. And Kesey now teaches writing at the University of Oregon, and his class has just published a collaborative novel called Caverns. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ken Kesey is my guest. You were among the first people to take LSD out of the clinical setting and use it in a social setting. How did you first get it out?
Of the hospital?
Yeah.
Ooh. Well, after I'd gone through these drug experiments and was in this little room in the hospital, looking out through the little window at the people out there who were the regular nuts. They weren't students going through experiments. Looking at them through my crazed eyes, I saw that these people have something going and there's a truth to it that people are missing. And that's how I came to write Cuckoo's Nest. I got a job at the Nut House and worked from midnight to 8, writing that book and taking care of these patients on this one ward, and made a lot of good friends, some that I still have. And I found that my key opened a lot of the doors to the doctor's offices where these drugs were being kept. That's how.
Huh. And then you had friends who were able to make it in their own laboratories.
Yeah, but they never was anywhere as good as that good government stuff. That's the government. The CIA always has the best stuff.
You know, you brought up Cuckoo's Nest, and I was wondering, when you were working in the psychiatric ward, which is what Cuckoo's Nest is based on, and I think you sometimes went in there high on hallucinogenics. Do you think you ended up writing Cuckoo's Nest in a way, projecting your experiences as a quote, sane person high on drugs, projecting those experiences onto people who maybe had, like, serious problems?
Well, these people that had serious problems, I mean, I saw people hallucinating and people in bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
Make no mistake about it, being crazy is painful, and being crazy is hell, whether you get it from taking a drug or whether it happens because you're just trying to lead the American way of life and it keeps kicking your legs out from under you. One way or another, it's hell on you, and it's nothing that's fun about it, and I am certainly not recommending it. It is a lens through which I looked at stuff, but it's hard on the eyes. But I think I had a very valid viewpoint, and much closer than a lot of the doctors were having. At that time, you know, everything was Freudian. If you were messed up, it was because of something that had happened to you when you were in the bathroom as a kid. And with these experiences, and I don't just mean drug experiences, there were a lot of other things that were going on that were emphasizing this. John Coltrane's music was saying the same thing. It was saying something is wrong and it's making us a little crazy, and that is making us crazy enough to hallucinate. Whether we were promoting it ourselves or it was being imposed on us, I don't want to argue that now, but I felt so good after being on there all night to know that I was wearing a green uniform, and I mean a white uniform instead of a green uniform, so I could leave in the morning and go home. Otherwise, there wasn't that much difference between me and those people they were locking up.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me an empathy that I could never have come up with. A better example is that those first three pages of Cuckoo's Nest were written on peyote. And I don't know any Indians. I don't know where that Indian came from. I've always felt humbled by that character. Without the character of that Indian, the book is a melodrama. You know, it's a straight battle between McMurphy and the big nurse. But that Indian's consciousness, to filter that through, that makes it exceptional.
Did you find that hallucinogenics would bring out things in your writing, or did you find also that sometimes it would be hard to write when you were high?
Oh, you see a lot of really groovy stuff on hallucinogenics and write it down and 24 hours look at it and realize, you know, I can't even read this. So there were a lot of mistakes made by everybody who thought they were doing wonderful creative works high on drugs, and then later on found that what they were doing was finger painting.
Have you given up drugs, or I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be asking this, but
we're into it now, go ahead.
do you still do them at all? Or?
On religious occasions, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like to walk up on a mountain on Easter and get a sense of rebirth. Some people jog, some people meditate, you know, there's certain people who whip themselves on the back. Everybody has their own way of trying to see past the veil, and this is just the one that I happen to come up with.
At what point did you decide to give up the kind of prankster's life? The story that I've heard is the pranksters went to Woodstock. You didn't want to go. And when they came back to a sign hung in your driveway that just said, no.
Well, there were 61 people when they headed out to Woodstock. And after they were gone, I went upstairs, and we live in a barn. We still live in the same barn, and we've fixed it up, and it's a pretty nice place. But at that time, there was still hay in the loft of the barn. And I found one of these little hippie warrens where they dug in with their ratty old sleeping bags and their copy of Zap magazine, and stuck right down in the hay bale was a candle, which had burned right down to the hay before it had gone off. And I thought, hey, enlightenment's one thing, but being this loose is... I mean, my grandpa wouldn't allow them up there, and my great-grandpa wouldn't have, and There's certain things that take precedent over enlightenment.
And that's when you send everybody home, basically.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, did you foresee in the 60s the drug problems of the 80s? Were...
No, not at all. Actually, I did in some way. I had I spoke to a bunch of citizens at the University of Oregon in probably 1969, and I told them that this was coming. The best thing to do about it would be to separate marijuana from all the other drugs by legalizing marijuana. I said that a long, long time ago, and I still believe it, that all of these other drugs which are connected to marijuana, and I really don't know much about those. That's why I don't get into them. I've never seen any of the stuff they're talking about, the crack and ice and stuff. So I kind of keep my talking about drugs about the stuff I know, and I really don't fool with it very much. My metaphor is this, is that you don't need a huge tuning fork. We used to think we used to have a tuning fork 8 foot long and weighed 2,000 pounds just to find middle C, but now all you need is a little bitty tuning fork once a year, maybe. But no, I don't know anybody who really goes out and gets ripped anymore. And I do feel some responsibility for what's come about. Although I've never tried to sell drugs, there's not enough to go around. I've always tried to sell truth. Just let people tell the truth about it, and pretty soon I think people will work it out, just like with cigarettes. Gradually, by telling the truth about cigarettes, less and less men are smoking. A lot of women are still smoking, but less and less men are smoking.
Ken Kesey, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, take it easy.
Ken Kesey's latest book is a collaborative novel written with his writing class at the University of Oregon. It's titled Caverns. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, John Frankenheimer. He's directed such films as The Manchurian Candidate, French Connection 2, The Birdman of Alcatraz, and 7 Days in May. His new film, The Fourth Wall, is a post-Cold War thriller. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The world's most sophisticated secret agent was the creation of novelist Ian Fleming. Now Ian Fleming is the hero of a new movie. TV critic David Bianculli has a review. Also, every year the World Watch Institute gives the Earth a physical, examining dozens of environmental, social, and economic indicators to see what kind of shape the planet's in. Coming up, World Watch President Lester Brown on the state of the world in 1990. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from one of jazz's wittiest songwriters, Dave Frischberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. With certain conditions, Israel has now agreed to U.S. peace proposals for the Middle East. It's been announced that cabinet ministers from Israeli Prime Minister Shamir's Likud bloc have approved a U.S. peace initiative with conditions. The ministers set forth certain conditions for proposed Israeli-Palestinian talks in Cairo. The first point is a call for coordination of positions with the left-leaning Labor Party, and consensus must be reached on preventing the PLO from taking over the peace process. In the United States, two groups representing state and local air pollution officials today attacked the Clean Air Compromise reached last week by negotiators for the Senate and for the Bush administration. They say the compromise bill will not protect public health. NPR's Michael Scholer has more.
Today, the compromise was criticized by the very people responsible for protecting the air. Two national associations, one representing state air pollution administrators and the other representing local air officials, complained in a letter to Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell that the compromise bill will make it hard for them to fully protect the air and the public. They argued that auto exhaust controls don't go far enough, that new factories will be allowed to spew up to 100 tons of toxic pollutants a year without any restriction, and that polluters will be given new ways to avoid meeting air standards. The state and local officials are urging the Senate to strengthen the bill. Floor debate begins this week. This is Michael Scholer in Washington.
The law requiring 60 days' notice before a plant can be shut down is a year old, and its impact is still being debated. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The plant closing law is not causing the trauma for business that opponents had predicted. That's according to labor groups and some economists. They point out that there has been no move to repeal the law because, they say, there has not been the devastating effects on the economy that President Reagan warned about before the measure passed Congress in 1988. But the National Association of Manufacturers says the law has been complicated, confusing, and difficult to deal with. The plant closing law requires that employers with at least 100 full-time workers give their employees 60 days advance notice before they close a plant. One effect of the law that both sides agree on is that many small businesses, which are not covered by the legislation, have been giving notice of plant shutdowns to their employees anyway, apparently because the mere existence of the law has put pressure on businesses to help laid-off workers make the transition. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The National League of Cities today called on the federal government to reinvest in the nation's towns and cities. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 11 points to close at 2,649.55 on volume of over 140 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz singer, songwriter, and pianist Dave Frischberg has a new album out called Let's Eat Home. Before he became known as a composer, Frischberg worked as a sideman for a variety of musicians, including singer Carmen McRae and tenor saxophonist Ben Webster, Al Cohn, and Zoot Sims. Frischberg also played and arranged for blues shouter Jimmy Rushing. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of Frischberg's latest.
Long as you're looking good, you can win the admiration of the common population. You can be a star, long as you're looking good. You have made the main connection. You can win the next election. Don't care who you are. Don't have to know a thing. Just look like you're a sensation. Don't have to dance or sing to get that standing ovation. Long as you're looking good.
composer and pianist Dave Frischberg has the voice of a 98-pound weakling. He sounds like the most well-developed part of his body is his adenoids. He probably wouldn't have much of a career as a singer if it weren't for the songs he writes. In a lot of ways, he's a throwback to great American songwriters like Cole Porter and Irving Berlin, who knew the value of a witty lyric.
Let's check out the news today. Let's see what the headlines say. Archduke of Zanzibar found slain in Danish spy's boudoir. Who got the scoop? Who got the poop? Our super reporter, Brenda Starr. World Series delayed by rain. Mad bomber to plead insane. Ex-wife of Russian czar will wed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Who wrote it up? Who sewed it up? Our super reporter, Brenda Starr. Making headlines, beating deadlines. Let me tell you, it's tough on the shoes. Here's a story, kind of gory. Man bites dog. Hey, that's news.
Dave Frischberg has a degree in journalism, which may explain his fascination with ephemera. He knows one thing that describes a culture best is the stuff we become preoccupied with that doesn't really matter. He builds durable lyrics from trendy buzzwords.
I like to stick with the first class ticket buyers. Setting trends with my trend-setting friends, the frequent flyers. I like to shop on the Champs-Élysées, eat curry in Old Bombay, and spend New Year's Eve in either Tel Aviv or Rome. But if it's all the same to you, let's eat home.
Let's Eat Home is the title track of Frischberg's new album for the Concord Jazz label. As a song about diminished expectations, it's sort of a modern twist on Ira Gershwin and Yip Harburg's lyric, Let's Take a Walk Around the Block. Frischberg often takes the deflated ego as his topic, which is one reason his agreeably puny voice is perfect for the words he writes.
I was ready, like a battleship at Pearl Harbor. I was steady, like a shave with a part-time barber. I was green, and need I tell you that isn't easy. But I was happy, not to mention grumpy and sneezy. I was rolling like a cue ball straight for the pocket. And I had no doubt just how things would turn out to be. I was sure and I was certain, but romance rang down the curtain. I was ready for her, but she wasn't ready for me.
There are times when Dave Frischberg gets a little too cute for his own good. To my mind, that joke about happy and grumpy and sneezy is one of them. To tell the truth, none of his stuff here ranks with his best songs, like Sweet Kentucky Ham or Blizzard of Lies. And Let's Eat Home isn't his strongest album. He wrote or co-wrote only 6 songs for it. He fills out the rest with piano renditions of tunes by Duke Ellington, Billy Strayhorn, and Al Cohn, some of which are saddled with fairly corny horn charts. He also sings one Rodgers and Hart song, and a hipped-up version of a melody by Edvard Grieg, with lyrics written for the musical, Song of Norway.
Strange music to my ears. Only now, as we speak, did it start. Strange music from the spheres. Can this lovely song be coming from my heart? You are near, and I hear sounds sublime, sounds that I'm incapable of. So, darling, little be near, while we treasure every measure, so that time can never change the strange music of love. Thank you.
Frischberg is a good and witty pianist, and his piano numbers add variety to his live sets, but they're not what I listen to his records for. My favorite Frischberg is his last album, Can't Take You Nowhere, which Fantasy Records put out in 1987. But the 3 years since have been a long time to wait, and even so-so Frischberg is still a treat.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Dave Frischberg's new album, Let's Eat Home, on the Concord Jazz label. This is Fresh Air. The continued burning of fossil fuels, soil erosion, acid rain, deforestation, are threatening the environment of the whole world. Can our planet be saved, or is it too late? Lester Brown and the World Watch Institute believe the next 40 years will decide. For the past 7 years, Brown and the Institute have been issuing annual reports charting the environmental state of the world. The report contains chapters outlining worldwide policy changes that need to be made to reverse the trend toward global self-destruction. This is the first of a two-part interview with Lester Brown about the global environment. Today we discuss the state of the world 1990. The biggest political story this past year was the changes in Eastern Europe. I asked Lester Brown if those changes might affect the environment.
I suppose the fortunate thing about this year, 1990, is that it represents a potential pivotal point in historical terms. The level of public concern about environmental issues, indeed about the future of the planet, is rising steadily. As it does so, the Cold War is winding down, and this at least creates the possibility of a major reordering of priorities in the use of public resources. We now have an opportunity to quite literally redefine security, recognizing that the principal threats to our future well-being now come less from military aggression and more from environmental degradation.
What are some of the other areas of improvement that you've seen in the past year?
Well, I suppose at the broader level, the political change in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union over the past year restore one's faith in miracles. And it's probably going to take a miracle to reverse the environmental degradation of the planet. Each year in our State of the World report, we in effect give the Earth an annual physical examination. And the results of this annual physical are not particularly reassuring. For example, each year we notice that the Earth's forests are smaller, the deserts are larger, the amount of topsoil in our cropland is diminishing, stratospheric ozone layer that protects us from harmful ultraviolet radiation is slowly being depleted. The number of plant and animal species on Earth is diminishing. The level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that are driving the global warming are increasing. So the trends are all still headed in the wrong direction. And the challenge now is to try to get at least some of these trends turned around during this decade. If we fail, then there's a good chance that by the end of this decade or shortly thereafter, that environmental degradation will lead to economic decline in many parts of the world, as it is already doing in parts of Africa. And then we'll be in a situation where environmental degradation and economic decline could begin to feed on each other, perhaps leading to social disintegration.
You described 1989 as the year that environmental issues moved into the political mainstream. What's some of the evidence for that?
In 1988, environmental issues moved into the mainstream of the communications media. Environmental issues moved onto page one of newspapers and onto the covers of weekly news magazines. In 1989, political leaders, taking their cue, I think, in part from the communications media, began to realize that environmental issues were serious issues from a political point of view. And so there was a scramble by national political leaders, particularly in Europe, to begin to associate themselves with environmental issues. For example, Prime Minister Thatcher in January of 1989 hosted an international conference on depletion of the stratospheric ozone layer. Now in 1990, I think we're reaching a point where political leaders have to go beyond hosting conferences and issuing proclamations and actually taking some of the tough decisions in energy policy and population policy that are needed if the world is to get onto an environmentally sustainable economic path.
Well, in the United States, George Bush has made it clear he wants to be known as the environmental president. How do you think he's doing in that area?
I'm afraid not too well at this point. The United States used to be a leader on global environmental issues. And at home, we pioneered in setting up the Environmental Protection Agency, Council on Environmental Quality, passing the initial Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, all during the Nixon administration. President Bush hasn't come close to even matching President Nixon in terms of the initiatives, much less providing leadership at the international level. In fact, the international community now views the United States as being part of the problem rather than part of the solution.
Politically, why is it important to see environmental issues as global issues, as international issues?
The early environmental problems like air and water pollution were pretty much local problems faced by local communities and within, for the most part, national boundaries. But now there are so many environmental problems that are becoming international, like acid rain, for example, between the United States and Canada or within Europe, and problems like deforestation of the Himalayas that affect the degree of flooding in all the countries in the subcontinent, like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and so forth. Beyond that, we now have genuinely global environmental issues for the first time, such as ozone depletion and climate change. No country acting unilaterally can stabilize its climate. Only the countries throughout the world working together can stabilize the Earth's climate. In protecting the ozone layer, one country can phase out the use of chlorofluorocarbons, the chemicals that damage the ozone layer, altogether. But if other countries don't do the same thing, then the ozone layer will be destroyed everywhere.
You said that stopping population growth is really one of the priorities in creating a sustainable society. Why?
The reason we think we need to pay a lot more attention to population growth and the need for family planning is because it looks to us as though population growth is going to slow in any event. The only question is whether it will slow because countries move quickly towards smaller families or because they fail to and death rates begin to rise as a result of increased hunger and malnutrition. And for a lot of third world countries, there are two models that they can look to. One we could call the Chinese model, where the government makes a serious effort to get the brakes on population growth to avoid a deterioration in living standards. The other model is what one might call the Ethiopian model, which is one where they pay no attention whatsoever to family planning and let population growth continue and then face a situation where the number of people outruns the food supply and they periodically experience massive famine. Ethiopia, again, this year is facing famine, and unless there's major food relief, could actually... 3 or 4 million people could face starvation, according to the reports, and this would be this is maybe the fourth famine or threat of famine that's occurred in Ethiopia over the last decade or two.
Lester Brown, we have an Earth Day coming up, April 22nd of this year. It's the 20th anniversary celebration of the first Earth Day. What are your hopes or expectations for it?
My hopes may be somewhat biased by the fact that I'm on the board of directors and the International Advisory Board as well. But it looks to us as though Earth Day in 1990 will be celebrated with activities and events of various kinds in more than 120 countries. This contrasts sharply with 1970, when the first Earth Day was principally a U.S. event. It looks to us as though the public outpouring of concern that we think is going to occur on Earth Day, Sunday, April 22nd, will dwarf any previous political demonstration of concern on any issue anywhere. There literally could be tens of millions of people around the world participating in various activities and events that will demonstrate their concern about what's happening to the Earth's environment. We think that this demonstration of concern about the future of the planet will send a message to national political leaders everywhere, making it clear that the time has come when people expect them to take action to reverse the degradation of the planet, and that making speeches and issuing communiques is simply no longer sufficient.
Do you have any suggestions on things people could do in their day-to-day life that would help environmentally?
The traditional advice on that question has been, you know, recycle your newspapers, return your bottles, and that sort of thing. And those things are still important, but far more important now, given the limited amount of time we have, is the need to become politically active, and to write letters to state governors, members of Congress, the White House. To actively lobby at the local and the national level on important environmental issues. We're beyond the point where we can sit back and expect a handful of environmentalists to bring about the amount of change that's needed in the time that's available.
Well, you've created a scenario of what a sustainable society might look like as it developed in the next 40 years, if indeed we were able to develop it. Next time on Fresh Air, why don't we talk about that?
Good idea.
Lester Brown is the head of the World Watch Institute, and he's the co-author of their new report, The State of the World 1990. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. The Poindexter trial opens today in Washington, the Iran-Contra trial of President Reagan's national security advisor, John Poindexter. There is a lot of talk about the possible release of hostages from the West being held in Iran. Rumors of talks involving U.S. officials, in fact. The reporter we talked to, Jim Muir, explains how Syria may be bringing pressure to bear, especially as regards the American hostages. NPR's Margot Adler reports on the problems at Pantheon Press in New York. The editor and several others there have resigned in protests over changes at Pantheon. Also, we'll talk with a man in Penobscot, Maine, who believes his town should pay no taxes.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, Turner Network Television is airing The Secret Life of Ian Fleming. It's a telemovie based on the early exploits of the writer who created the character James Bond. TV critic David Bianculli says the movie highlights experiences and mannerisms shared by Bond and Fleming.
My name is Fleming. Ian Fleming. I'm with Reuters.
The Secret Life of Ian Fleming isn't very good, but the idea behind it is great, and there's a lot of enjoyable little treasures buried in it. Basically, the more you like the James Bond novels and movies, the more you'll like this stylish but kind of silly TV biography. The most inventive thing about the movie is the casting. Ian Fleming is played by Jason Connery, whose father, Sean Connery, was the movie's first and best James Bond. The producer of The Secret Life of Ian Fleming says of his young star, and I quote, "We cast him not because he was Jason Connery, but because he was the best." Yeah, right. Anyway, Jason Connery's not bad. He even gets to storm a castle with flair, just like he did as the star of Showtime's Robin Hood series. Back then, though, he had shoulder-length hair and wore rags. As Ian Fleming, his hair is short and slicked back, his clothes attest to Fleming's aristocratic background, and, like James Bond, he's a lady killer. According to this TNT movie, Fleming was thrown out of two prep schools because of dangerous liaisons with beautiful women. One of them the general's wife at a military academy. Fleming's mother then sends him to work at Reuters News Service, where he starts out writing obituaries. But before long, a loyal secretary, played by Marcia Fitzallen, helps him land a plum assignment in Moscow. She also has a knack for throwing hats on a hat stand and is the obvious inspiration for James Bond's money penny.
Thank you, Delaney.
Whatever do you mean?
Well, who gave him my records? Who else but you had access to them?
What a shocking read it was to him. Whatever is it that makes these women fall at your feet so readily?
Perhaps when I get back from Moscow, I'll show you.
In Moscow, Fleming meets a beautiful Russian spy. Every woman he meets, by the way, is beautiful, just like in the Bond films. And he starts behaving, or misbehaving, just like 007.
Your lips?
What? What about them?
They're cold.
Make them warm.
When he returns, he's recruited by an Admiral Godfrey, played by David Warner, to join Britain's Secret Service. Fleming learns a lot from Godfrey, including, at their first meeting, how to order a drink.
I'll have a martini, please, shaken, not stirred. I'll have the same.
You can see why this is fun, even if it's not very exciting. We get to see the real-life inspirations for the gadget-creating character of Q, the mini-submarines of Thunderball, the casino scene from Diamonds Are Forever, and, of course, all those Bond women. Kristen Scott Thomas, who starred opposite Prince in Under the Cherry Moon, plays Ian Fleming's one true love, but there are lots of false ones. Director Ferdinand Fairfax films The Secret Life of Ian Fleming more like a Bogart film than a Bond film, which is okay. The film noir look fits nicely. But the teleplay by Robert J. Avreck is so loosely based on Fleming's life that it's hard to tell what to believe. But if you just go along for the ride and for the fun of it, it's almost like a low-budget production of James Bond, the early years. Dramatically, though, it'll leave you neither shaken nor stirred.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, and Ojiva Blytus. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Goldfinger, he's the man, the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch, such a cold finger.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, director John Frankenheimer talks about his movies The Manchurian Candidate, French Connection 2, and his latest, The Fourth War, about two soldiers who refused to let the Cold War end. Also, Lester Brown of the World Watch Institute returns with his prescription for an environmentally stable planet. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.